was supposed to also give an introduction to quantum gravity effects in quantum mechanical systems. And let me just repeat for you that we know that quantum gravity should be emergent. That classical general relativity is an emergent, is either emergent from some pre-metric structure or is emergent from the quantum version of gravity, or your preferred quantum gravity theory, which is generically does not express things in terms of metric variables. So as I said, it's very difficult to imagine how how to make to recover GR in a precise sense, given that the particles are not the true quantum objects are never point-like, and things become even worse when space-time itself has its internal structure. So if you have an object that is extended as any quantum object is, and quantum gravity fundamentally has some structure that is not exactly a metric structure, or even an extremely complicated metric structure. At the fundamental level, even if you decide you will think about quantum gravity in terms of a metric, perhaps there are all sorts of fluctuations of the metric at very, very short distances. How is it that this macroscopic large wave function, when filling all this strange structure, suddenly satisfies the equivalence principle? It is very difficult to imagine how something like that would occur. But how would this underlying structure become manifest? Well, perhaps asymmetry violations like the parity violation in the weak interaction. Perhaps by the value of some of the constants. We would like to understand the value of some fundamental constants or something that we believe to be fundamental constants in terms of the properties of this underlying structure, very much like we understand the properties of a solid or of a fluid in terms of the molecules and atoms that makes them up. Perhaps in terms of some exponents, which in general we don't find strange or non-integer exponents appearing in our theories, but if the theories are effective, then perhaps we should think of something that resembles our description of phase transition and physical phenomena where non-trivial exponents appear. And there seems to be very few ideas going in that direction. Perhaps something completely different, but what? How can we even advance in exploring these ideas if we don't have a workable theory? Is it hopeless? The fact is that we don't have any workable theory of quantum gravity. No one of the proposed theories, despite all their advances, can allow me to compute what is the gravity field of a superposition of two quantum mechanical, of a system that is in a superposition of being in two different places. I cannot compute what is the gravity field of something like that. Okay, so in some sense one may think it's hopeless to try to do that, but in this, going in the other direction, I just want to note that we discovered atoms very long before we were able to reach the atomic scale, right? We discovered atoms in some sense with Dalton's law of the definite and multiple proportions by looking how macroscopic chemical elements combine themselves before we were able to, much before Rutherford was able to explore the inside of an atom. We discovered the weak interaction much before we reached the mass scale of the W and C bosons, and we discovered gravity well before reaching the Planck scale. So perhaps our prejudice that say we will never see effects unless we get to that scale is something that we need to revise. And this is in some sense the positive thing. On the other hand, what has been studied so far? What do we know about the interface of quantum systems with gravity? Well, we have the famous Kao experiments, which are basically interferometer experiments with neutrons. These are very old, from the 70s. And as I mentioned already, cold neutrons in Grenoble that are, in some sense, producing atoms in which the nuclei, in the nucleus is replaced by the Earth, and these neutrons are the electrons in the orbits of the of the neutrons, something remarkable, technologically a remarkable achievement. But when you look at these experiments, you realize that they are sensitive to little g and not curvature. And curvature is where Einsteinian gravity resides. Little g is just a measure of the fact that you are not in an inertial frame where your laws of physics are supposed to apply. If you go to an inertial frame, all the gravity disappears from those experiments. And then we are missing the very important thing. How does curvature really affect the behavior of a quantum system? And what do we know about that? Almost nothing. There is almost no experiment in which this thing has been tested. On the other hand, we generally adopt the view that even in flat space-time, there would be manifestations of quantum gravity. And that has been the underlying assumption that has led people to look for violations of Lorentz invariants or things like DSR. My personal view is that very difficult nowadays to reconcile Lorentz invariance with the not only with the evaluation of Lorentz invariance, not only with the very strong existing bounds that have been obtained in the last decade or so, but also with the results from quantum field theory, which we know works very well. This is the so-called naturalness problem, and I think we have to be careful because giving a name to a problem doesn't make it go away, right? So regarding DSR, which in a sense is an interesting proposal spiritually in looking for a possibility that you may see effects even if there are no preferred frames, I think this very serious conceptual problems make the situation very hard to deal, in particular to do phenomenology. You may be able to work and advance in doing theory with that, but when you want to do phenomenology, you really need to know how to map the symbols of your theory to the things that appear in the lab. If not, it's very, very hard. So the interpretational difficulties that afflict this program, I think, should be the focus of work if we are ever going to really be able to use them for exploring phenomenology, because matching the objects of the theory with the objects in the world is fundamental in this sense. So are there other manifestations which do not involve Lorentz invariants? Evaluations? Are there other possibilities to where we can look for things? As I said, it's very difficult to see what can be done. What are the systems where one may look for actual tests? Where we have quantum mechanical systems that are relatively large and superfluids, superconductors, Bose-Einstein condensates, and Casimir effects seem to be the most promising directions. I have heard studies in this couple of two, but I have never seen any proposal involving the Casimir effect. But that's perhaps I haven't found it in the literature, and it's there. So if somebody knows about something like that, I would be very interesting to hear. One very interesting proposal that I should mention here is this proposal by Docker, Henson, and Sorkin of decoherence of photons controlled or parameterized by the affine distance traveled by these photons. This is very interesting because the proposal is completely Lorentz invariant and nevertheless is testable. One can generalize this idea in a sense by proposing things that will afflict the behavior of massive particles as a function of the proper time. So things that live for a long, long time and we can explore them for a very long period of proper time, in some sense, these clocks that we heard this morning, if we can test the fact that they don't decohere due to gravity effects for extremely long times, would put bounds on proposals, would put bounds on theories. And if we see something, it would be very, very interesting. The value of the cosmological constant is one very promising direction, in particular because we have now measured the value, and we have no way to understand what this value is. I should say, regarding the cosmological constant, a subject on which we will have two talks two things. First of all, I should say that the standard prediction that we know to be wrong by 120 orders of magnitude comes basically from computing this integral, which gives something of the order of mass Planck to the fourth, but is clearly depends on violation of Lorentz invariant. We're going to put a cutoff at a wavelength of the order of Planck scale, but measuring our frame. So we are already seeing that our frame of reference, or perhaps the cosmological, is a preferred frame. So in a sense, this prediction, I think, is wrong not only by 120 orders of magnitude, but it also at least forgets to note this very drastic premise that is behind it. On the other hand, I should mention the ideas of Sorkin that are based on the causal set program that make a prediction of the value of lambda that surprisingly is very close to the actual value. And I say surprising because that prediction is a little bit strange in the sense that this cosmological constant is not really a constant in that scheme, but is something that is changing as the volume, as the four volume of the universe changes, and it's not clear then exactly how we can consider it a cosmological constant, how it really fits into Einstein's equations, but it's remarkable the fact that it fits with the numbers. When numbers fit, even if something is wrong in the understanding, is something that should draw our attention. Anyway, we have two talks about the cosmological constant now, and one talk about using matter wave interferometry to look for. I didn't understand exactly what we will look for. Perhaps extra dimension modified version of the uncertainty principle, but that's simply because the abstract was very short and I couldn't get to see what was going to be done. But anyway, we will discover it pretty soon. So please, the first speaker for you this afternoon is Alfio Bonanno.
I just resisted
my... And it's you who is going to...
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. The organizer.
To switch.
For inviting.
Ah. Don't turn it off. Okay. Don't turn it off.
And that's something I've been working on for the last couple of years. Not exactly this title, but then I realized when I got the invitation from the people here that I could, the work I'm actually doing with Martin Reuter has some implication, might be inspiring for people to do matter wave interferometry. And so let me first go back to a couple of questions I think we should try to address before we talk about experiments. Because I hear in most of the talks today that the idea people have of the Planck scale is that the Planck scale is sort of has a non-trivial structure. So it's sort of a chaotic or random geometry which should appear at some scale. Some people talk about fractal structure or granular or whatever. So. And then the question is, why is that? Why do we believe that? Why nearly everybody believes that there is a noise at the quantum level? And I think that the author of this of this idea is the conformal factor instability. Because in a very seminal paper around the 80s, it was by Jaffe and others, it was clearly demonstrated that flat space-time is unstable. And so therefore, if it is unstable, then this stability must be there. I think that's where that comes from. And that somehow has spread out, because the problem is still there. Is the flat space-time stable or unstable? And so then we have to go one step back to the question, do all the quantum gravity theories share the same view, Fermi view of the Planck scale? Because before we set up an experiment, we have to have an idea what it's going to be. Otherwise, we can get every number we want. So let's go to the first point. Let's imagine that there is a quantum form at this stage. And then the idea is that if you have this fuzziness at the Planck scale, this will act at some point as in the Brownian motion theory from that we observe every day at atomic scale. And then some people have thought that this can produce a defacing in a matter wave interferometer. Basically, the idea works in this way. So you have, I don't have to speak too much about that because it was discussed before. This is a Ramsey type of interferometer where you have these two laser beams which splits this atom beam and they recombine here. Then you have this interference factor. And so what happens? The phase of the matter wave is proportional to the flight time, as we heard in the first talk. If our space-time is smooth, as we would imagine, in a classical environment. Though if we have a stochastic component, then what will happen is we will have a perturbation of the phase, which will have to go as the square root of the flight time. So that's in principle, if we will be able to look for very, very long times, we should be able to see the difference, this transition from the classical to the quantum, Brownian motion. That was a very nice idea, and some people have been talking about that. So I don't know exactly what is happening and what is the status of this idea. But it's the point I would like to make, it this exactly comes from the point of view that there is a stochastic field at the Planck scale. And now if we imagine instead that gravity has a non-trivial fixed point, so other people will talk about that. So let's take that for granted because I have only 15 minutes, but there have been lots of work in this direction. And so there is a dimensionless cosmological constant, that is a dimensionless Newton constant, so that you can actually take this limit. That's the framework asymptotic safety. What is then the structure of vacuum state? And then once I get this answer, I can try to see whether I can see something matter wave interferometry. The first thing which occurs is basically that all the phase time you see can be described very nicely only looking at the fluctuation of the conformal factor. So the conformal factor really captures most of the real important degrees of freedom in taking the ultraviolet limit, in pushing the limit far beyond the Planck scale up to lambda equals infinity. And many people have done that before us. And then the question is the following. If the conformal factor plays such an important role in creating this ultraviolet fixed point, the question is how do we stabilize that? What makes that stable? And so another possibility, which was put forward a few years ago, is that we have a kinetic condensate. And where this idea come from? The idea come from the following, that if you include another term where you have an eigenderivative term, just a quadratic term in the Einstein-Lagrangian, the degrees of freedom actually the propagator, I mean, it's basically given by this, by an expression of this type. I mean, the Fourier transform of the kinetic part in the Lagrangian, what really matters for the conformal factor, has this shape. So at very large momenta, the unstable phase of the conformal factor is basically compensated by the fourth order term, which comes from this higher order operator, which is in front of this term. If that is true, then it makes no sense to talk about unitarity when we expand around the wrong vacuum. Because now, even classically, you see that you have a condensation here at this minimum. And so all the discussion about unitarity of Higer derivative theories are complete nonsense unless we choose the right vacuum. And so now the question we try to answer is, what happens in the real case of Einstein-Hilbert-Lagrangian plus this term? Because one important prediction of asymptotic safety is that this term is positive, it is there, with this coupling positive. And so what we did was we tried to study a conformally reduced theory, because it's already extremely difficult to try to tackle that theory as it is. So we did a conformally flat reduction of the system, and then you have to deal with this dilaton type of Lagrangian. That is, you see, that is the dilaton, and that is this beta term, which contains the eigenderivative term. And then you have to solve this awful, terribly complicated equation of motion. It's a fourth-order elliptic equation, and there are no available methods you can buy in the market to solve this equation. So after a long fight, we decided we got some solution, but the best was to put everything on a lattice, where you can really understand if you, in the lattice people language, that you have a competing interaction between these eigenderivative terms, which is basically a next to nearest neighbor, which coupled with the Ising type interaction here. Only when you do that, you can really appreciate the nonlinearity of your action. But everything is completely very well common for solid state people, we realized after we did that. And then we try to solve this directly minimizing the action on a two-dimensional lattice. And the answer was this was one of the solutions we got. That is basically...
Sorry, what's the graph?
Okay, this graph is the solution of for the dilaton that you get if you take this action and you put this action in a lattice and you ask the lattice, you ask any numerical method, now minimize that and tell me where is the ground state, where is the, okay? That is what we got. At least in two dimensions, you can do up to 120 times 120 lattice. And
that's the wave function of the dilaton?
Exactly. The wave function is it's really a solution which minimize, it's a stationary point of the path integral for this section. So you take this section, you take the path integral, and you ask yourself, what is a stationary point? It's not constant. That is what I would like to say. It's not flat space. It's not constant. It's not flat space time. The minimum of the action is given by something like that. But in some case, you have also, depending, you can...
So the horizontal direction is space?
Yeah, you have two space directions, x and x, exactly. And this 8 is of the order of the Planck length. So basically, yes?
So your solution breaks Lorentz
invariance? Yes, at the Planck scale.
Why is there a preferred direction?
Wait, a moment. So these are 2D simulations. So I would like to, that is, we really have a lasagna type of vacuum. And not a spaghetti vacuum. So that is the important message I would like to send across this audience. So the structure of the vacuum is very well ordered. It's not foamy. And about this preferred direction, yes. At the moment it's Euclidean, but this two-dimensional phase, of course, you will get in any 3+1 foliation. So this is not new. This type of vacuum are very well known to people who work in condensed matter. This is a type of anti-ferromagnetic material. And a very common material of that is the hematitis. So the point is that what is happening is that you have two competing type of interaction. These interaction are competing in such a way that the ground state of the theory is non-constant, it's not homogeneous. So what will happen? Probably we have a domain, vice domain structure. So in some domain, we have two lattice of this type. In some other domain, we might have other lattice of this type. And that will eventually create sort of a defacing, if you want. But if you take only one big domain, everything is very, very well ordered. There is nothing like anything noisy. And then the question is, can we detect this type of vacuum? So because now we have a completely different experimental setup. And now let's go back to Bordet-Ramsey interferometer. We heard a lot before. And what you have to do, you have this metric. We got from a variational calculation. Basically, we got also an expression, a free expression for this metric. And you have to solve the Schrödinger equation for an atom of this metric. What I did not say is that the frequency of that oscillation is of the order of 1 over square root of beta times Planck time.
So this is
the frequency of this wave. Yes, it is basically. Yes, this actually there are two waves, two periods. One is given by the cosmological constant, but I don't want to go to the detail of that.
Beta is a large or small number.
Beta, that is a good question. There are no strong limit on beta. It can be 10 to the 80. And that is the point.
There are strong limits, right? For the solar system, we know that there are R-square.
The strongest one I found is 10 to the 80 from Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Anyway, if you do that, that's the message, the final result that you get. The defacing angle is basically given by an expression of this type, where k is the wave vector of the laser, t is the flying time of the atom, m is the mass of the atom. And if we estimate, we could not have the time to do a complete calculation, but if we estimate this thing, what happens is that you get this number. So depending on the value of beta, in principle, 1 minute, okay. I'm almost ready. Depending on the value of beta, this angle could be actually detectable, but in a very different way. So what I think people who work in matter interferometry should do, you should look at the residuals of your data and look if the residuals of your data depends on the direction. Because it's clear, because if the wave is in this way, lasagna is in this wave, and I cross in this wave, then I get a different feeling than if I go in the other direction. So please look at the residuals of your data and see if there is a difference in the direction going in one direction or the other direction. Because I will interpret this as a systematic error, which is not an error, but which is something which may come from this mechanism. In any case, you will get a bound on beta in the worst case. So conclusion is that asymptotically safe vacuum is very well ordered on Planck scale. We have a spontaneous breaking of translational invariance at the Planck scale. And depending on the value of beta, we cannot exclude to detect this effect in matter wave interferometry. So last but not least, don't forget this. Yes. Yes, we should not be too serious.
In that calculation, you assume that the whole interferometer is within one vice domain.
Oh, yes, of course, of course.
There is an additional scale here.
There is an additional scale, but we have... Yes, we are now computing the propagator to see exactly what is the Weiss domain size, but that's a really tough calculation. We hope to do it, but in principle, you are right.
But so what will happen?
When I get the
answer, if the domains were small.
I don't know, because you must know the surface tension between one vast domain and the other to answer your question. So,
so it does have multiple domains. I mean, is there an energy density associated with the interfaces and stuff? Do you have any
idea? I think so. But we have to. I mean, that's just calculate the. I mean, the first thing is calculate that. Then. I have to compute the propagator, and that is, you have to compute the propagator on this solution. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really much more complicating. So it was already very difficult to write the code which makes this minimization of this function, because, I mean, there is nothing around you can buy and use it.
I have one question.
Yes.
In the last expression, you have
this is a Mount Etna, by the way, the volcano in Sicily.
Okay, good place for skiing.
Yes, when there is snow. Yeah.
Can you show the last expression?
Yes.
The Riemann curvature is that. That this is the Riemann curvature.
This is the Riemann curvature.
How did it appear in your calculation, which was
because. No, because I have the solution. That is a solution for sigma. No, I know that the G mu nu is E, the sigma delta mu nu. Then I have this, and I calculate the Riemann from that.
Okay.
And that is the Riemann.
Because you assume the two directions that you have plotted in your two-dimensional thing coincide with this.
Yes, that is just, exactly. That's just to estimate the effect.
Okay. Sorry. Any other questions?
So in the end, I don't know if you answered what is the source of this anisotropy?
Yes, the source of the anisotropy is the comes exactly from the fact that the system has to reorganize in a different state, which has some modulation. Now, we know from solid state physics, in the case of spin wave systems, that every time you have a spontaneous breaking of the symmetry, it always happens like that. There is basically the system reorganized so that there are new degrees of freedom. The symmetry is broken along only one particular direction, and the price that you pay is that you have to have a lower action is to have a phase which is modulated. So it is a sort of a spin wave solution. And then in that case, we always know from solid state that there is one preferred direction which is randomly chosen, of course.
How do you choose it?
No, it's a random. So I don't choose. I mean, the system, what happens is that you do a sort of a Monte Carlo simulation. You plug some random field, and the random field randomly chooses its vacuum. So I don't choose anything. Oma, that is not, that's just a plotting thing.
It's just the way you plot it.
Yeah, that is just the way you plot it. I mean, usually it can be also in the other direction. Yes, anything, yes.
Okay.
One more question. Yeah, you started off
one.
By saying, where does this Fominis picture come from? And I think this Fominis picture of space-time is older than what you're saying. It's just that people think that if you have the space-time, it's supposed to be quantum mechanical, then you have this composition of all possible space-time. So it could be any bubble, anything happening where, and that's this Fominis picture, which I think is older than.
Yeah, but if you don't have any stability, you cannot have any bubble.
If you don't have.
I mean, how do you get the idea of a bubble if you don't have any stability?
Well, I mean, these are. No, these are good questions, but I mean,
so historically, I think that paper was the one who has triggered this idea, because like Rayleigh-Taylor instability, we know that because there is an instability.
But perhaps there is a way to interpolate between the two pictures, because if these domains become very, very small and you have many of them altogether, it will look very foamy in a sense, right?
Maybe.
you put many of them.
Yeah, but then the type of noise will be different from pure white noise. Because there is a scale.
There is a scale.
So in any case, it will be different.
Which is beta.
Which may run. But I mean, there will be the type of noise. That's why I said you should look at the residuals.
Okay.
The type of noise should be.
A very quick one. The time scale of those variations of the residual, is it fading or?
The time scale is, or the frequency is this one. So it depends on beta. If beta is the order one, it's Planck frequency. If beta is 10 to the 80, can be meters. Or even kilometers.
Okay.
If beta, yeah, even kilometers. And so that's why one can put a limit on beta.
And then the Earth goes through those domains, and that sets the time scale.
I think that we don't know. Unless we know beta precisely, it's difficult to answer your question.
Okay, I think we will have to continue this interesting discussion
which,
afterwards because we have two more talks.
I look on Wikipedia at the moment and it was 10 to the 80. So when it comes to.
I think there are better limits.
Yeah, maybe. Thank you.
But, the next speaker is.